It's Muhammad Ali. So we'll be back shortly.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Rich Strong.
Breaking news is shots have been fired outside of one of the main airports in Dallas. More from USA Radio's John Clemens.
Details are very sketchy, but several shots have been fired by what is believed to be law enforcement officials outside the baggage claim area of Love Field in Dallas, Texas. Brian Armstrong of Flashy Films had just arrived at the airport when he posted this on Instagram. I'm John Clemens.
There are late reports this may have been a domestic dispute. Hillary Clinton is almost tied with Donald Trump in a new poll from Fox News. The poll puts Clinton ahead 3 points, but that is within the margin of error. Clinton has 42% to Trump's 39. This is USA Radio News.
Hey, it's Rusty Humphreys, host of Trending Today USA, where we feature the biggest and the best and the brightest trending stories in the world. One of the places I go first every single day is WesternJournalism.com. Chris Agee's here. He's the managing editor of WesternJournalism.com. What makes WesternJournalism.com so special?
Well, Rusty, I think it is very special. We bring you the news as it actually happens. We're one of the places that you can come for the facts, and they're backed up by what's actually happening out there.
You know, a lot of websites, they deal in rumor and innuendo. You guys are really dealing in journalism, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And there's no question that we're going to bring you pro-American news. I mean, we're going to bring you stuff that makes you proud of the freedoms that we have. And we back up the Constitution every step of the way, but that doesn't influence our reporting. Our reporting is the truth, is 100% accurate.
Make sure you check it out. One of the best websites in the world, WesternJournalism.com. That's WesternJournalism.com.
The weather is helping firefighters in the Tenderfoot fire that is burning near Yarnell in Arizona. More on the story from Sandra Harrows.
The flames continue to consume acre after acre. So far, 5,000 have burned. It was touch and go for residents, but the winds are pushing Tenderfoot away from residential areas. However, hundreds of people cannot yet return home. Dolores Garcia with the Bureau of Land Management.
Last thing we want to do is have residents go back into an unsafe situation, and that's our primary concern right now, is we want to make sure that they go home to power and electricity, and that the infrastructure in that area is not going to be a threat.
The fire is 10% contained, and while it's expected to burn for several days, firefighters say, quote, we're looking good. I'm Sandra Harrows.
Aftershocks in the desert in San Diego County. An earthquake this morning just before 1 a.m. local time. It measured 5.2 on the Richter scale. Residents from San Diego all the way north to L.A. say they felt the quake. Breaking news on the web at WesternJournalism.com. This is USA Radio News.
I'm Sean Hare, the site director at conservativetribune.com. Conservative Tribune is one of the most visited news sites in the world, and the reason is simple. ConservativeTribune.com delivers edgy and bold commentary of the news every day. We are unapologetically pro-America, unabashedly conservative. At ConservativeTribune.com, we don't make apologies for who we are or what we say. If you're looking for more than boring stories and simple thought, visit ConservativeTribune.com. That's ConservativeTribune.com.
New emails released by the State Department raise new questions about Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. ABC is reporting a major donor to the foundation was put on a government intelligence advisory board with no experience in the field. He's a securities trader in Chicago. The Belmont Stakes is coming up. Local officials say they're ready for it.
Nassau County Executive Ed Mangano says the race is an economic boom for Long Island.
We expect the Belmont Stakes has about a $10 million economic impact here to our great county, in addition to all of the hotel stays.
And even though there is no Triple Crown contender in this year's race, huge crowds are still expected for both the races and the concert. Nassau County Police are urging racegoers to use the Long Island Railroad to get to the track and say strict security will be in place. Terry Sheridan, Long Island.
A Mississippi man enjoys life again after a heart transplant. More on the story from Randy Bell.
Played a lot of basketball in his life, but the Jackson man had to quit because of congestive heart failure. But next week, he's going to be stepping onto the court to compete in a sports festival with a new heart that he got 2 years ago.
I may have a competitive edge. I'm 51 years old, but I have an 18-year-old heart in my chest, so I'll let that be a surprise to all of them.
But not too much of a surprise. Lewis will be competing against other transplant recipients in several sports in the 2016 Transplant Games of America in Cleveland, Ohio. Randy Bell in Jackson.
And I'm Richard Strong, USA Radio News.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Okay, if you want to lose weight, go out and exercise and do some sports. Right, Bill? Bill's here. We're going to start.
Get up off that couch. But, you know, it's a sad day in sports.
But let's talk about weather first. I know it's a sad day.
We're going to talk about the weather. It's a beautiful day.
It's a great day outside. It has been just terrific outside. Although, Bill, you said you might want to go to your boat tomorrow. There's about a 20% chance of showers here, and then even later in the afternoon, some 30% chance of thunderstorms. And again, tomorrow night, about a 40%. So really the best day of the weekend is in the morning on Sunday, and then in the afternoon it should be breezy. So if you have a choice, I guess I would go and either check out the weather at the shore, and that's what everybody has to do because the weather can be so different, right?
Oh, it always is. In a marine environment, you never really know. We're going to a picnic at our marina on Saturday, and I have the boat's in the water. I've got one sail on. I still have to clean up the top sides. But other than that, she's ready.
Well, that's great, and we have a lot of sports news. We hope to see John here shortly. But
some sad news in the world of boxing. My childhood hero, Muhammad Ali, who I remember as when he was still Cassius Clay, passed away this week at the age of 74. I remember very fondly the 1960 Olympics, which my paternal grandfather and I shared because we both liked boxing. And we both liked who was then Cassius Clay. We both liked the fact that he was a very brash, outspoken character. And everybody said, well, you know, he's kind of extreme or over the top, although they used words which were very derogatory back then.
Did they really? I don't remember. I remember when he came back to the United States, and here he was, won the Olympics, gold medal winner, and, you know, couldn't get served and at you know, in restaurants in his hometown.
Well, that was an outrage.
Yes, it was, and that is something I remember. I thought he had a really great sense of humor.
He did indeed. He liked to say that he would float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. And I always thought that was such a cool thing for a boxer to say. Now, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, Grandpa Harry, was by profession a hat maker. And he had learned how to make hats when he was a young man in World War I. He was in the Russian army, the Tsar's army. He was captured by the Germans in late 1914, and they put him in a prison camp with lots of other Russian soldiers. But the Germans treated them very well. They fed them well. They clothed them well, housed them well. And if they found kids, they taught him a trade, and he was about 16 at the time. So he moved to New York and went into the work of being a hat maker.
Well, let me ask you, though. How is it that he became a boxing fan?
Because as a kid.
And really? In Russia?
In Russia. And he had boxed in the POW camp. He was what I think you would now call a flyweight then, because, you know, he was maybe 16 or 17 when he was a POW. And he was quick. He had quick hands, and he taught me head fakes. He taught me all sorts of moves. So, you know, when you're an eight or nine-year-old child and your grandfather's teaching you how to fight and teaching you how to maneuver and then taking you to the Golden Gloves, which we went to every year until he passed away when I was 13, We saw a lot of boxing together, and when I would stay with him on Saturday nights, usually in the summer, there was always boxing on TV, or else we would go to a gym, and sometimes we would watch people train on his way home from work.
Well, I'm sure that many people have their own recollections and remembrance of Ali, especially, of course, people that grew up in Kentucky. And I guess one of the things that I remember best was when they stripped him of his title, and because he was a conscientious objector. And I guess not many people probably know that that case wound its way through the courts, and the Supreme Court, of course, voted 8-0 that, in fact, he did qualify as a conscientious objector.
He did qualify.
Yes, he did.
Oh, he had very strong beliefs against the Vietnam War. He was once joked and said, I ain't mad at no Viet Congs. And I think I was about 12 or 13 when I heard that. And I always thought he was the coolest guy in the world. But I will tell you, as a kid, I had a scrapbook of boxers. And I would cut the pictures out of the New York Post. And it was fun. Well, and here's a man with no bad habits, John Manfreda,
and no good habits either, Bill.
He no longer has to wear glasses. He's had his eye surgery.
Yep, that's why I walked in with sunglasses on, but okay. I'm hanging in there. People, oh, my God, this is the first time I've seen you guys.
That's right.
Pat, you're more beautiful than I ever thought. Bill, you're incredibly handsome for an 80-year-old.
That's true. Thank you. And I'm considering I'm only 64. But,
there you go.
But, you know, people are mistaking John Manfreda for Johnny Depp.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, whoa. I'm not so sure if you had read some of the recent news about Johnny Depp that you would want to ever use that term.
Or, for that matter, Nelson Aguilar. But who's, you know.
So you were talking about,
Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali and our recollections.
And Gordie Howe, another Gordie great Howe. Legend, passed right. away today, this morning, I guess.
Yeah, Gordie Howe, I think, was 87 or 88.
88, I believe.
And, 88 is what I heard.
I will tell you a Gordie Howe story. I am 11 years old. My grandfather has taken me to Madison Square Garden to watch the Detroit Red Wings due to the New York Rangers, large dogs due to small critters or large bowls of food. And we had actually gotten really good seats because it was the Saturday of my birthday weekend, and we're sitting just on the goal side of the Detroit bench, and Gordie Howe comes off from his skate and he kind of winks at me a little bit and waves.
How about that? Not every 11-year-old kid can say that. That's pretty cool.
I was thrilled.
I saw Gordie Howe play once in Boston Garden, but I was so far away. Of course, you know what's funny? The old Garden was the way it was built. It was what you hovered over, even though you were on the second balcony in obstructed view seats. They were better seats than I have today in the Prudential Center for the Devils.
I
saw Gordie Howe play. So I actually saw him play at least one, maybe two. I remember one distinctly.
Well, I saw Gordie Howe play for the Hartford Arrows when he was in the WHA.
Or wasn't that Hartford Whalers? I think it was Houston Arrows.
Houston Arrows. They were right.
Because
the
why did he join that team, Bill?
Because his son Mark was playing defense for
and
him.
His other son.
His other
Marty was on the team. And they actually got on a line together.
That's
okay,
right.
It was the Howe line.
Exactly.
Okay.
I saw the Hartford Whalers play the Philadelphia Blazers maybe a dozen times.
And Derek Sanderson.
The famous Derek Lifebulb-Eating Sanderson, a man who was truly a character. I don't know if he's still alive. He was a Bruin broadcaster for a while.
He was. There's a whole story. We'll do a show on that someday, a whole Sanderson story,
Gordie,
and Bobby Orr.
But you know what a Gordie Howe hat trick was, John.
Yep, that was a game in which he scored a goal, had an assist, and got in a fight.
Right. And had a five-minute penalty.
Major, at least
got in a fight.
Major.
Yeah.
Major fight. Yeah. Not just a little.
Fight. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Because it's coming back to me now. I think it was 1970 or maybe 71, and he was still playing for the Red Wings. And Detroit actually had a decent team at that time. That was the old Alex Delvecchio team, at the end. Guy had gray hair, and he's out there. And, of course, the Bruins were big, bad Bruins in those days. And they were fighting. And I remember Orr and Howe passing each other. It was, in between, but blown the whistle, and you know how the players kind of glide around in circles to get back to, and they passed each other, and somebody said, "Wow, look at that! There's Bobby Orr and Gordie Howe." And do you know what Bobby Orr's middle name is? Gordon.
Really?
Guess who he was named after?
Gordie Howe.
Gordie
wow.
Howe. Robert Gordon
wow.
Orr. His name. Yeah. His
he
middle
was
name
really
is Gordon.
Named after him.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
I never knew that. That's
yeah.
a he was
his
that
middle name is
old.
Gordon. Yeah.
But was he really named after Gordon?
His family was,
huge.
He was born in Parry Sound, Ontario.
Yeah.
The only thing you had, and this is even worse than being in Wisconsin, okay? The only thing you had was hockey. I mean, at least in Wisconsin you have the Packers and you have a couple other teams, but the only thing you know in Parry Sound, Ontario is NHL 16.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was named after Gordie Howe. And remember he passed, and some older guy, we were young kids in high school, and some guy said, "Look at that, Orr and Howe right next to each other," because they were chatting a little bit. You could see their lips moving. You know, it was like an incredible moment that probably wasn't even captured on camera, because in those days they probably had three or four cameras at a game, not 17 like today. And we kind of saw them. There was a face-off in the Bruins' end. So Howe was up in the face-off circle, and of course Orr being a defenseman, and they were chatting for a moment in, while they're waiting for the referee to set the play up. And you can only imagine what they might have spun. You know, Orr was about 19 at the time, 19 or 20. And Gordie Howe was, what, 47, 48?
Yeah, he played a long time.
He played 24 seasons.
That's right. He played his last game at the age of 60.
Yes.
With the Houston Arrows.
Right.
Yeah, with the Houston Arrows of the WHA.
Yeah.
But Gordie Howe was considered a fan favorite.
Oh, he was, definitely.
Yeah. And I even in rival arenas, I remember going to the Spectrum and getting there early. And he was standing around with, I think, Ralph Backstrom and Alex Delvecchio, a defenseman that you mentioned. And
Alex was a center, but go ahead.
Excuse me. And Detroit had a goal.
Don't mind, but Bill and I do this constantly. And in the next 30 seconds, Bill will correct me. We do. It's a game we play. We do.
was it Terry Sawchuk who was the goalie?
Yeah.
They were standing around outside the Detroit locker room, and they just decided they would stand around and sign anybody's autograph who wanted one, as long as they were under 12 years old or 13 years
old. Is that
old.
Right?
Yeah, if you're said, and Howe said, okay, folks, we're going to sign some autographs, but you can't be older than 13, or we're not going to give you an autograph. And they sat
really?
And stood there, and they just signed.
Now, this was where?
In
right,
Philly.
But well, I understand at the Spectrum, but like, where were you? Were you near the players' bench? Where was it where the players come out?
We were
in the parking lot?
No, we were actually in the underneath the stands. I'm sorry, we were in the stands at the runway where the Red Wings
the runway.
Were come out.
Okay.
Where
some people have been known to get on Zamboni machines, right, Pat?
I've been known to have a Zamboni ride every now and then. But more importantly, so he and Sawchuk and a bunch of other people, and I was 17 or 18, I was in college.
Oh, so you tried to pose as a 12-year-old?
No. And I was so sorry I hadn't brought my brother, who was 11 years younger than I. And because it would have been a lot of fun. A couple of years later, my brother, who is now about 7 or 8, I brought him to a Red Wings game, and the Flyers beat the Red Wings. I remember it was score 12-2. Oh. Gordie Howe was no longer playing. It was like when the Red Wings.
Right. That really was their Babylonian stopped. Captivity.
Exactly. They had become a terrible team. And
for years,
lost lots of games, and it was right around the time of the Broad Street Bully era. So the Flyers were literally beating and beating up on just about everybody. And somebody made a comment in the stands. Boy, Gordie Howe would have never stood for that. Well, of course, a couple years later, Mark Howe becomes a Flyer.
Right.
And he was one of the better defensemen.
He was a very good. He was an all-star. He was a very good defenseman.
He was an all-star 4 times.
Yeah.
And Howe had, Howe as a defenseman, had a couple of 25-goal, 50-assist seasons.
Yeah. Marty was not as good a player, but Mark Howe was very good.
Marty Howe had a lot of speed and a decent shot, but his stick handling and his game anticipation was not anywhere.
It just wasn't there. Yeah. I wondered if that was it, or if he had been injured earlier in his career and that hampered him.
That could have been.
Could have been, but I think
Marty had hip surgery a couple of times.
Well, there you go. I always wondered about that, but that interesting.
Yeah. But you know, getting back to Gordie Howe and the Bruins, wasn't there an incident where Howe and Teddy Green went at it?
Oh, of course. That's very famous in Boston. That's why Gordie Howe's hated in Boston. What happened was Gordie Howe swung his stick and almost killed Ted Green. Ted Green missed 2 years and and broke his skull, had a fractured skull. Absolutely.
I'm surprised.
I'm sorry. It wasn't Gordie Howe. Gordie Howe punched him out, floored him. It was another player that hit him. It wasn't Gordie Howe who hit him with the stick. I'm sorry. That's wrong. I forget the name of the player, but it wasn't Howe. But Gordie Howe, because Ted Green, before he had injured, was a big, you know, mean defenseman that would, you know, get people in the corner, and he was a big brute. And Gordie Howe laid him out flat one time.
Well, Teddy Green was always a goon in my book.
No, he wasn't a goon, but he was a little bit above a goon. He wasn't Dallas Smith, Bobby, Don Ory. He wasn't that true. But no, he was an excellent defenseman.
That's
before.
True.
He wasn't a goon. He was just a tough, tough player.
Well,
weren't they all back then? I mean,
yes,
that's what I remember.
Degree.
I used to watch the Blackhawks, yep. And as I said to Bill before you got in, I had to stop. We had this little bitty color, black and white television. I had to stop watching because my two little girls were starting to really.
The guy
they
I
got
hated.
Into it.
Do you remember the guy? One of the all-time worst. The guy I hated so much was Keith Magnusson.
Oh, everybody
and one
hated
time,
him. He was a Black
Hawk. Every time they played the Bruins, Magnusson would take a cheap shot at Orr, knee him, hit him again. One night, right in Chicago, going through center ice, Magnusson says or does something, and Bobby Orr, who almost never, ever fought anybody and got, I mean, he was big and tough, but he was just so well respected. Magnusson did something. Orr turned on a dime, went after him, hauled him down, put his face on the ice, and beat his, and the refs didn't do a thing. They just, because they all hated Magnusson. At the end of this fight, half of the Blackhawk logo was red. There was a pool of blood at center ice. The refs didn't do one thing. Later, Orr apologized for the incident, but he said, you know, he had it coming to him. And even his own teammates, Magnusson's and the Blackhawks, said, yeah, he probably did. The Blackhawks were a nasty team. They had some good players. I was like Dennis Hull. Bobby, I saw Bobby Hull play
Bobby
one time.
Bobby Hull was great.
Hull, well, sure. But it's funny. Here we are on a beautiful summer day reminiscing about old-time hockey. And, you know, I guess the Penguins lost last night, so it's back to San Jose. And now, you know, here you are in the middle of June, and they're still playing. And, you know, what you said before, Pat, a couple minutes ago, about the old era, and weren't they all tough? You know, I look at these players now, and I only go back to the my first game was like 69, the very late 60s, okay? And then I really got into hockey at that point. But, I mean, these players today, I'm sorry, they are ridiculous. Cindy Crosby, he looked at me the wrong way. Give him 2 minutes for staring. You know, I mean, these guys are so ridiculous. It's hard to get into this. Hockey is really hurting right now. Hurting.
I don't think.
Well, and the length of the season.
The length, it's so ridiculous. Well,
I've said that before.
4 years ago when they had the strike,
they had
a 39-game season. They set all kinds of attendance records. What does that tell you? The games were twice as important.
Well, and frankly, not only were the games important, but those of us who were football fans, we kind of, you get into football and, you know, hockey's kind of there. But that year, it was great because
it picked up in January.
Right.
As soon as your team was out of the playoffs in football, hey, you had to have another rooting interest. So there were your Blackhawks or your Minnesota North Stars or your
The Minnesota North Stars.
Yeah, I don't think Minnesota is that popular.
Minnesota Black Stars.
North Stars.
Black Stars.
The North Stars. They became the Dallas Stars.
They became the Dallas Stars.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites, funny you mentioned that, Bill, and you will probably remember this. It's in my office, hanging in one of my collages. One of my favorite all-time. You know how these sports writers are so clever. The way they phrase the columns they write. And after the first game of the Dallas Stars, New Jersey Devils Stanley Cup Championship Series in 2000. This was the 2000 Cup. In which Dallas was favored in the series because nobody knew just how good New Jersey was at that time. Well, the Devils embarrassed them like 5-1 in the first game. And the headline across the Star Ledger was, "Devils are the Stars." And I have that as part of my logo. I cut that out and said, I think the Devils are going to win the series. And I'm going to put this in my collage. And that's in my – next time you're in my office, Bill, Pat, you can look up and see that. Devils are the Stars.
Well,
boy, that seems so long ago, 2000.
That's really cool. But
that was one of my favorite all-times.
Well, it was a while ago.
16 seasons ago. But, you know, the interesting thing is how Pittsburgh literally got blown up except for Fleury, Malkin, and Sidney Crosby.
Yeah.
And they've remade the team out of all kinds of people.
They've got good front management, Bill. They've got good people. Mario is still
done
there.
They've done a great job there.
They've really done a good job.
In 2 years, they went from being a doormat.
Yes.
In
fact, somebody called.
By the Rangers to now they're in the finals, and they're up 3-2.
So somebody called in WIP just making that point two nights ago and was bemoaning the fact, you know, they're cross-state rivals. That here we are, the Flyers. We haven't won since 1975. And the Penguins, this is going to be their fourth cup. So it really, really cool, bitter. And I think it was Jody Mack said, well, you know, you're talking a different era, the 70s to now. But unfortunately, you're right. But they've done it the right way through the draft, shrewd trading, good management, disciplined hockey. Because remember, what affectionately did we used to call the Penguins, Bill? The Dips.
The Dips, that's right. The debtors
in possession.
They went into Chapter 11 because they owed Mario Lemieux so much money on his contract.
They wound up awarding him the team because he was the only secured creditor. He was the secured creditor with the highest priority.
Right.
That and nobody else wanted it.
Exactly.
Made him a winner. And he took it, and look where it is today. It's worth about $400 million, the team.
Oh, yeah. It's always been one of the jewels.
So whoever was Mario's bankruptcy lawyer did a pretty good job, Bill.
Did a great job.
But for years, we'd go there, and Bill would sit with these at Pittsburgh at New Jersey, and Bill would be explaining to me the intricacies of the, you know, how the Penguins made payroll. Because it was an interesting legal question, and it was because as financially unsound as the Devils have been over the years, the Penguins through that period were worse. And there was one time where there was an article in the paper whether they were going to make the trip to New Jersey to play the game. And Bill was telling me how, I don't know, you did some research or something, and how they were able. Using some of your bankruptcy, shell game stuff, able to make payroll and get the players in.
Well, that's true. The Penguins had
because people
problem
in the stands
too.
Listened to listening to me and Bill talk. They thought
we're idiots.
They think we didn't know anything about it. Listen to those two lawyers talking over there. They don't even know what the game is. Meanwhile, we know more than they'll ever.
Yeah,
than they've
as far as some of these people are concerned, we might have been speaking ancient Etruscan or Babylonian.
Absolutely, if not Abyssinian, of course.
You know, but you know, the interesting thing is the Pens played in probably the worst arena I've ever been in. The igloo in
Pittsburgh.
And you went to that. I've
been in the
there?
Igloo maybe 10 times, and if ever a building deserved to be bombed,
imploded,
and knocked flat, imploded.
Well, wasn't that the arena? And remember, they made the movie. It was a hockey movie.
No, they didn't make Slapshot there.
And not Slapshot. It was a hockey movie about a bomb going off. They timed the bomb so that when the clock hit 000, it was going to explode.
I've never seen that movie.
Bill, you know B movies?
Yeah.
This is like an F. This is such a horrible movie. And a bunch of NHL players. Mike Modano was in a bunch of them made cameo appearances in the movie.
Cool.
I think the title of the movie was something like Sudden Death, something like that.
Oh, but there was
my point is the situs of the game was the igloo.
Yeah, and the igloo was the kind of place where if you sat in the upper deck. You had and it was a cold night in February. I was sitting in a seat, and three seats over is this very pretty young woman, and the water starts pouring out of the ceiling onto her hair, and she was sort of a Jersey
girl. And you being the gentleman you were.
Nope, I simply moved further away. I didn't want to get wet.
The real story, folks, is that Bill ran to her rescue. enveloped her, protected her, cleansed her.
Okay, guys, that's enough.
We'll go
we're going to go.
I was wearing my Flyers sweater. No
when
way.
We come back, I'm going to tell you about my trip to Fenway Park
she
last
was a
Saturday.
Pens fan, John. I was wearing my Flyers sweater.
She had her powder blue on, right?
No, they didn't have that one then. But the igloo was
to be continued.
In parlance.
At Crown Trophy of Flemington, we have thousands of products for you to choose from. Whether you're looking for trophies, plaques, or corporate awards, Crown Trophy of Flemington is your one-stop shop. We feature acrylic and crystal awards and promotional products for any occasion. We build and engrave all awards right on site. And we're a leading supplier of varsity jackets for local sports teams. We provide quality customer service and great pricing. Crown Trophy of Flemington is conveniently located in the Staples Shopping Center in Flemington. Crown Trophy of Flemington, we're trophies and a whole lot more.
This is Tony Clark, Para Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters of Weikert Realtors. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime, and selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then, I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technology to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let me show you how to take my level of professional expertise and put it to work for you in achieving your real estate goals and dreams. I can be reached at 908-238-0118. Thanks for your time.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber?
We're back on the air. They're still at it. You can't believe
we never stop.
We never stop that. That's one thing about us. You know, when John gets tired, I've wound up. When I start to wind down, John's still going. So, you know, Pat, you're really
we're quite a tag team.
Midwesterner, we stop and let you get a word in edgewise.
Actually, that's true, Bill. We have been very discourteous to our
no,
partner.
No, you haven't
today.
At
why,
all.
Why should
you're
we
the
be
hockey
courteous
guy.
To
yeah, the there you go.
Fan.
We're Northeastern guys. You're right. We play.
I was thinking that we would have really had a fight if we talked a lot about Muhammad Ali today. But let's hear about Fenway.
Okay, real quick, I had the pleasure of going to Fenway Park for the umpteenth hundredth time on Saturday. My daughter Allison and her wonderful boyfriend Garrett and his family managed to get us great tickets just to the left of home plate on the third base side in the first section. We had unbelievable seats, and what was really good about them is there's a – it's right on the edge of the screen, so a foul ball can't come back and get you. But having said that, we had a perfect day, 73 degrees. We saw a wonderful game. The Red Sox beat the Blue Jays. There were a couple of unusual things. The game-winning hit was Big Poppy hit a rope, and I mean a rope, into right field to score two runs. And I was perfectly lined up when he swung. I saw the ball literally just like a laser go over the second baseman's head into right field. That's how hard he hit the ball. But we had a wonderful time. We had a nice lunch. And it was, you know, first time my meeting my perhaps future daughter's perhaps future in-laws. And when we got ready to leave, you know, we it was a bittersweet. I know it was a good relationship. It's going to be a good relationship because everybody hated to say goodbye. And I think that's a really nice thing to be able to say. And I agree with you, Pat. How could anybody not love my daughter?
Well,
you're right.
Said.
But let me ask you, since you brought up the screens, did you find there was any problem seeing the game? You
absolutely
know, there's
not.
All
no.
of the hoopla, and
no.
people are really getting hurt.
They got to extend the screens even more. In fact, the family has been sitting in these seats for 23 years. They're Garrett's dad's like best friend's ticket. So he's, I mean, Garrett's 26. Like Al says, he says, Mr. Manfreda, my dad's been taking me to these seats since I was a little kid. I said, well, did you ever think you'd be sitting in those seats with perhaps your future intended? And he thought about that, and he said, boy, that, you know. But anyway, he's a great kid. They told me a story of how they took their family there. This was maybe 10, 15 years ago, and his sister, whose name is Liza, was sitting in the seat, and the screen wasn't – in those days, that screen was only right. behind the plate. And they were telling me this before the start of the game. Somebody – a left-handed batter swung late and fouled – again, we're on the third base side.
Right.
The ball came back, and he said to me – the dad said, I saw this ball coming straight at my daughter's head. It was too quick. I couldn't reach it. She was staring off in the distance. At the last second, must have just been a reflex. She moved her head, and the ball hit the back of the seat right behind her. It would have killed
wow.
her.
Wow.
Would have killed her. They think of that every single time they go there and sit there. So they were relieved when this year they extended the screen over because it was right in front of us, you know, maybe a little couple of feet to the left of us. So they covered that area.
And so, you didn't find any
absolutely not, Pat. It was that you look right through it. To me, it was well worth the relaxation you got because that's one of the things. I mean, in Fenway, I very often sat in the third base. I probably with my daughter Allison at least since she's been at BU in 2008, probably 10 times, easy. And every single time, I always have her sit to my left. So if the ball's going to come, I'm on the right between her and the ball, and I'm always nervous about that. And this was well worth it, being behind the screen.
Well, that's great. You know, I've always found that in Yankee Stadium, the screen was not an obstruction for me. I never felt if I sat behind home plate and about 10 rows up or behind the visitor's dugout and 6 rows up, I never found that screen was in the way.
But, Bill, also at Yankee Stadium, you're further back. At Fenway, you're very close.
Oh, yeah, because
of right,
well,
and
you,
that's
you're very are. Far back most but, of the seats
know,
in Yankee Stadium.
In the old Yankee Stadium,
in the old
the foul,
yeah.
foul territory was really small, just
yes.
like it still is in Fenway. Now
correct,
you're
yes.
further back.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
But when you went to the old Yankee Stadium, you had a very fair chance of a foul ball coming right over the dugout into the area where you were sitting, particularly if you're sitting on the third base side. Now, on the right field side, it was even worse because the Yankees had a lot of left-handed hitters in
yeah.
the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Stuck with that short right field porch.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know if you ever watched Brian Gumbel's program, but he had, you know, they did some testing and showed that, you know, people cannot react fast enough.
Oh, no. I've yeah. gone to hundreds of baseball games, and I'd say maybe 10 times, let's say, a ball came near me, and I breathed a sigh. I would never – you see it, but you can't react. Plus, the ball is moving laterally. You cannot react. Very frequently, people move right into the ball.
That's
just
right.
Like you see batters get hit, they often move into – well, for spectators, it's even worse.
Well, go try to hit good minor league pitching. Forget about big league pitching. That ball is moving all over the place.
Yeah.
I just watched a film about knuckleballers was made about 2009 or 2010. They had Phil Negro on.
Hoyt Wilhelm.
Hoyt Wilhelm, who's now a very old
Joe
man.
Negro.
Joe Negro, Phil's brother. They had R.A. Dickey and the guy from the Red Sox.
Tim Wakefield.
And they were talking about how do you hit one of these things. And Derek Jeter was interviewed, and he said that I've never been able to hit one. The only time you can ever hit a knuckleball is if, for some reason, the pitcher makes a mistake and the ball...
It doesn't tumble as much. They call it tumbling. A curveball breaks. A knuckleball tumbles. Now, it's interesting you say that, Bill, because we were pretty close to the field, and Stephen Wright was the Red Sox pitcher on Saturday. And... he's a knuckleballer. He's one of only two. There's Dickey and Wright. Those are the only two in the game right now. You could actually see the ball flutter as it came up to the plate. Now, what's interesting is everybody was bemoaning the fact there were five pass balls in the first two innings. The Red Sox catcher was not his usual catcher, could not control the ball. In fact, Toronto ultimately scored two runs on pass balls.
Well, you know how Carlton Fisk said you would – what's the right way to catch a knuckleball? You wait for it to stop rolling, and then you pick it up.
Pick it up. Yeah.
It's very interesting.
One of the greatest catchers of all time. He said he could not control it.
And they would give him
many
a larger
teams,
glove.
Many teams – actually, they were just talking about this the other day on the Yankee broadcast, and they were saying that when the Yankees had – who was the knuckleballer the Yankees had? And they had a catcher. I think it was Mirabella. Paul Mirabella was the best catcher in the majors. He was a guy who was a great defensive catcher, could not hit.
He was a 202 hitter, but
he could stop but he was so quick that he could catch a knuckleball pitcher.
Whoa.
The Yankees traded him – who was this pitcher? I'm trying to remember. To San Diego. And San Diego didn't have the presence of mind to throw him in to the trade. So a couple of weeks after the trade, they call up the Yankees and say, we want Mirabella. And Brian Cashman shrewdly said, and we'd love to have your first pick next year. And the Yankees extorted. Of course, we're talking San Diego here, not very smart. And but they extort him for Paul Mirabella because the value of a catcher who can catch your top knuckleball pitcher. I mean, right now, Stephen Wright is tied with David Price for victories on the team. And R.A. Dickey's good, too. If you have a good knuckleball pitcher, you have to have – you've got to carry that catcher just to catch that guy.
Now, the game you went to had a very interesting play at the plate, and you were in a perfect
position.
Let's hear about that.
What happened was there was a ball hit to the outfield. They missed the cutoff man.
Who was on?
I believe it was Xander Bogaerts was on second. He came around third.
Who was hitting?
And it was Mookie Betts. I think it was Betts.
Okay.
And the Toronto did not hit the cutoff man, and they relayed it in. Betts appeared to be out at first blush, but he jumped up
at the plate
on a very close play. And in fact, I think it was Garrett, Allison's boyfriend, said he was safe. You know, and John Farrell came out and they showed it in super slow motion. That's why these umps have a tough job. It turns out that the catcher, and this is usually what happens, they catch the ball and then they instinctively go to tag the guy's shoulder. By that time, he had reached in with his long arms and touched the plate just before the shoulder was tagged by the catcher, and they reversed the call in the field and called him safe. So you're seeing more and more and more of that. And but yeah, that was an exciting play. There was also a play which when they have the blooper plays on for the Red Sox, you'll see this. Toronto scored two runners scored on a bunt. What happened was the play, there was second and third. And it wasn't a suicide squeeze or anything, but there was a bunt. The runner on third came down the line. The catcher, who I think was Hannigan, threw to first, and the runner at second for Toronto, who I think was their third baseman, good young fast player, never stopped coming around third. Guess what? There was nobody at the plate because the catcher took off to cover first on the relay, and there was nobody at the plate.
The pitcher was supposed to cover
the plate. The pitcher, exactly correct, Bill. He was not up there, and two runs came around to score, and Stephen Wright, the knuckleball pitcher.
Who caught the bunt? I'm not following this. Who caught the bunt?
Actually.
The bunt was down third.
The bunt was down third. All right. The third baseman came in to field it. The catcher takes off up the first baseline. The pitcher is supposed to go behind the plate, as Bill just said. He didn't. Okay. They made the play at first. The third baseman makes the throw, and he's still halfway up the line. He doesn't realize that the runner is running right because his back is to third base.
Wait a second.
The guy runs around third and just keeps going to the plate. There was nobody there to catch the relay.
Well, why did he throw to first? He couldn't get him out at home? He couldn't get the guy on third
because
home?
The bunt was good enough. He couldn't get that lead runner.
Okay.
So he goes to first to get the out.
Not realizing.
The guy on second flies around third, comes all the way home. And there was a hush over Fenway Park. Because the Red Sox lead the majors in second steals. They are a running team now, but they've never been in their history. But they got a lot of young, fast players. And some guy said, hey, we usually do that. And funny part was later in the game, the Red Sox stole two bases the same way off of Toronto, missing the cutoff guy and all that. So the running game is back in the American League. You know, the American League, Bill, was pitching in 3-run homers, right?
Right.
National League is all about stolen base. With certain teams, the Orioles and the Red Sox, no coincidence, they're up near the top. And the Royals last year are a running team. And they're taking the extra base. They're looking for not hitting, taking advantage where the cutoff guys and hit, play, the home plate's uncovered. They come, and we saw a lot of that running game. We saw a double steal. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff going on in the game.
That's what makes baseball so much fun.
Actually more fun now than sitting back and waiting for the 3-run homer.
Well, that, you know, as a kid, that was the thing that we used to watch with the Braves, and there were some really
National League baseball.
They were some really good base dealers.
Set the table for Hank Aaron hit a 3-run homer.
Yeah. Well, you're right, but the point was, it was just always, you were always watching that guy on first base who would get about halfway down to second, and then, you know, whether or not the pitcher was going to try to, you know, pull him back or not, and you know, and sometimes every once in a while, of course, that pitcher would overthrow, and then, you know, he'd get to not only second but third.
But you know, but the other thing too was because it was a National League.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that
big difference. There was no DH.
Right.
And
well, that's true.
But even before the DH, Bill, I would wager they ran
and
more.
And you know, the Yankees and the larger market teams were buying up all the power hitters.
Right.
What happened was you had pitchers, great pitchers like Warren Spahn that were also
on
great
teams
bunters.
That never won anything.
No. He was on the Braves.
What did the Braves win?
They won 57. Yeah, they won in 57. But I remember watching a Mets game. Spahn comes up to bat. Adcock is on first. And I forget who the Mets pitcher was, but Spahn lays down the most beautiful bunt.
Pitchers could bunt in those days.
And Joe Adcock, not a fast runner. It's now
he's a big guy, though.
One out. Pardon?
He was such a big guy.
Yeah.
His career.
His spread. I mean, he could
that's why he was a first baseman. He could catch everything.
He could catch halfway down to the second base.
Yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, for a guy as big as he was, he had the reflexes to dig a ball out of the dirt on a throw. I was always so impressed with Joe Adcock.
No, I really liked him.
Good player.
Well, that was a great team. I mean,
they had Eddie Matthews at third,
and he was the pretty boy, of course.
Was he really?
Oh,
I don't remember. I don't.
He was single.
Oh,
do you remember who? You remember who the Braves' third baseman was when they moved to Atlanta in 1966?
I thought it was Eddie Matthews.
Joe Torre.
That's true. You're right.
I
know he later became a catcher.
Right. Yeah, he played third base at that time. Anyway, Pat, I know you wanted to talk boxing. Let's shift for
I just wondered what, you know, remember
all grew
boxing.
Up with Muhammad Ali changed the heavyweight division. He unified the title, but because of his charisma, you couldn't help but, I mean, he just captivated the world.
Oh, he did.
But, you know, the interesting thing was he had a lot of detractors because in the days before fanatical Islam, you had a lot. This was the beginning of the sort of radical movement, and that was very unpopular. Don't you remember Floyd Patterson? Remember the fight where we tortured him? Patterson couldn't get close to him. Muhammad Ali's arm was like 39 inches, and he kept hitting him, saying, "What's my name? What's my name?" And he'd say, "Cassius Clay." Boom, and hit him again. "What's my name?" And he kept him up for four rounds because he could have put him out at any time, just punishing him. But Patterson wouldn't give in. He kept calling him Cassius Clay. There were people in the heavyweight division, in the boxing world, who didn't accept all that. And then, of course, you had the draft piece. And a lot of people get on him for the draft because he could have been drafted. There was no way he was going to be sent to the front lines. He would have been doing exhibitions. He would have been able to continue his professional career. But he was the one who was a conscientious
objector. But he was a conscientious objector.
But he lost 3 years. He paid a steep price for it.
But he was vindicated by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, he was.
And which had to be some real interesting discussions.
But
with
remember,
some of
what
those
was that? That was the Douglas Court, the ultimate
liberal
court.
But no,
Burger
but
Court.
No,
Warren, no. Warren wasn't. If you looked at the people on that court, Potter Stewart was fine, but there were some Southerners that they were not.
It was amazing that
it really was amazing. Yeah. In fact,
Let me ask you a judicial trivia question. What member of that Supreme Court was also a running back for the Pitt for Pitt?
Oh, I know that actually.
In what era? Byron Wizard White.
Exactly.
Wizard White was,
right.
Yeah.
Byron Wizard
But was he on
was
that
Supreme Court justice?
Was he on that court when they made that decision?
I think
so.
He was on the court into the 60s. I think he was.
He could have been.
But you know, you're also talking about a court
Harlan,
the Miranda decision, all of the constitutional criminal
cases. Yeah, but Harlan,
they were, you know.
Now, I have to tell you, my understanding of that.
Thurgood Marshall ended up on that court.
Thurgood Marshall ended up in that court.
But
yeah.
My understanding was that there were some minds that were changed, that they were not going to agree, but they really had to. I mean, if you really
look at that now, it was a shocking decision at the time. That was when they were developing the penumbral rights theory, which led to Roe versus Wade in 1973.
But you're not looking
they
at
found the existence of penumbral
but
rights.
You're not looking at the Quran. I mean, you know, the fact is, I mean, I believe he had a very sincere belief, and if you looked at those beliefs, it was absolutely justified to be a conscientious objector. Nobody really thought that because everybody had talked about all the major religions. And so that, you know, if he had been, you know, Catholic or Lutheran or whatever, he could not have had it based on religious grounds. But the fact is, what was amazing to me is I once heard an interview where they were asking him about whether or not he really hated that draft board, et cetera, and he basically said, no, they were doing their job. And so, you know, they called it the way they saw it, and, you know, here he lost 3 years, which was amazing. And, in fact, didn't he have to fight that fight over in Zaire? Or was that something that they wanted to do?
Yeah, I think he fought one or two fights because he couldn't get a license to fight here.
He did have to fight.
Well, I think he
fight
fought
in Zaire.
Africa.
He did Zaire.
The Rumble in the Jungle, and I think
Thrill in Manila.
Thrill in Manila with Sonny Liston.
Yeah,
and he beat Sonny Liston mercilessly. Sonny Liston was, I always thought, a great big thug. I remember him fighting Floyd Patterson, and Sonny Liston was the guy I loved to hate. And there was a tremendous uproar when Ali fought him in Manila, and I think it was like a 7 or 8 rounds, and Liston had to throw in the towel. He just couldn't resist anywhere, couldn't defend himself.
Yeah, those were some great days. You know, and that's like we were talking before about Gordie Howe, and it's sort of here we are. Obviously, we're kind of senior people now, but and young people who may be listening may be thinking that, you know, we're in our rocking chairs on the stoop. What unfortunately the young people today are missing out on because of the technological era and the internet, that they're missing out on those characters. They're missing out. You know, we in those days identified with those people. I mean, we followed them. We were lucky to watch them on a black and white TV listen on radio. I mean, you know, now these guys watch, I watch the Red Sox in San Francisco on my iPhone the other night. Yeah, I mean, I'm part of it too. But I think that there's, because of all the media, it's just a different era in terms of following sports.
Well, the other thing too is you're overwhelmed. Unless you only pick your one or two teams in each sport, you're bombarded. There's just too much.
Very much so.
Overload. You know, now we can see it all. Remember?
Yes.
I remember coming east and, you know, we were lucky to get a Green Bay Packers score.
Oh, yeah.
And forget about finding. Yeah.